This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm here with Dr. Chris Flynn from the Swinburne University of Technology on Australia. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you work on FRBs, fast radio bursts. Could you give us a little bit of a rundown as to what they are?
All right, so fast radio bursts were discovered about 10 years ago. They're extremely bright sort of flashes of radio waves that only last for a few milliseconds, but have a huge number going off every day. So every 5 minutes or so, one of these things flashes somewhere in the sky. So we had radio eyes. You would just see these things flashing off, and they'd be the brightest thing on the sky. Every 5 minutes, one of these things is going off. As far as we know, they're coming from all directions on the sky. The number is really surprising. There's very few things in astronomy that happen so often every day, and we have no idea what they are yet.
That reminds me of something that I've seen, that there are more theories as to what fast radio bursts are than we currently have published FRB observations.
Yeah, that's right. And although the FRBs are starting to catch up, so in the last 6 months, 12 months, things have really heated up, and the number of FRBs have kind of doubled in that time. And we're sort of getting towards 75 or so known. So we're starting to catch up with the theories.
Interesting. And what kind of theories are there? And are there any that are looking more likely than others in light of the recent ones that have come in?
So I don't really think that we've got any good constraints on which theories are best right now. The theories are all there. It's such early days that most of the theories are really quite speculative, and very few of them can make predictions about what we should be seeing. So I think that there's quite a lot of maturing that needs to go on. And right now we're really being driven by the things that we can do observationally rather than theoretically.
Speaking of observationally, how is it that you go about capturing an FRB and determine some of its properties?
Right. So the trick is you need really high time resolution. So, of course, they're going, they're only milliseconds or even faster than that. So what we basically need to do is get a big radio telescope, and every on a very short time scale, we look for these very bright blips that go off. So to do that, you need very fast processing. And that means, and the way we do it at the telescope I work at is we've got $250,000 worth of video games machines and just stack them all in a big rack. So what's happened recently is that the graphics processing units that go in video games are the fastest computers on the planet, and the bang for buck is fantastic. And so this was recognized a few years ago, and that's why people are starting to use video games machines to do this.
And it's the Mongolo telescope that you work on, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So what could you describe that telescope a little bit and tell us all about it?
So it's the biggest, physically it's the biggest telescope in the southern hemisphere. It's 1.6 kilometers long, so an old-fashioned mile, and then 1.6 kilometers long in the other direction, so across. So there's sort of 200 tons of metal and concrete that we can move very slowly. So it moves so slow you can hardly see it moving. You have to stand there and convince yourself. And it's very special because it's got a huge field of view. So it can see something like 20 times the size of the full moon. And that's great. That's exactly why we decided to go and refit it, which is what we're doing with all kinds of new electronics and the GPUs, so we could search for fast radio bursts.
Hmm. And is there any particular reason why you have it in the, the T-shape or the cross-shape that it is, with two perpendicular arms?
That's an historical thing. So it was built 50 years ago, a little over 50 years ago. That's a convenient design at the time. It could have been just, you could spread it over an entire field, but with this design, it means that you can physically control it much, much more easily than you do today. So these days, you wouldn't do that. You'd spread things all over the place, but in those days, it was appropriate.
And I know one of the, one of the aspects of FFRBs is that it can be quite hard to localize whereabouts in the sky they've come from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all the FFRBs until we went to Malanga were being found with parkes. So that's a big, it's a big 60 meter single dish. The thing about single dishes, first of all, there's a quite rough area on the sky from which the things can come. But they can also leak in from the sides quite easily. So you're never quite sure. The way around that is to use what's called an interferometer. So you just get a whole bunch of telescopes, get all the signals together, line all the signals up, and get a much better localization for where they come on the sky. And that's what we're super keen to do right now, because we think the next big thing for fast radio bursts is to figure out when you see one, to catch it live with enough precision to know exactly which galaxy it's coming from.
And in that respect, is it a little bit analogous to the gravitational wave detections and the electromagnetic counterpart that was, within the past few years has been?
Yeah, exactly.
Used?
So the gravitational waves had even like hugely worse localization than even FRBs. So that presented super challenges to like map so much sky when you're trying to figure out where they're coming from by looking for other signals at other wavelengths. But we've got the advantage is that we get the first time we see it, we want to localize it that one and only time that we get it.
And what kind of timescales are you working on for that?
So we think we'll be, like, within a few months, we'll be getting all the electronics built and ordered and put on the telescope. So six to 12 months now. From now, we're hoping to get our first galaxy.
Oh, that's interesting. So from receiving a kind of first indication that you've got a fast radio burst, is it something that you want to be kind of identifying that as soon as possible and then doing follow-up? And what kind of process do you go through, or do the electronics go through, once you've detected a fast radio burst?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So the very first fast radio burst that was found, it was found 7 years after it had actually hit the telescope by looking in archival data. And in the last couple of years, we've got to the point where you get train a computer system to actually recognize that they've happened and just do it automatically. So no humans needed. And that you've got for our system, you've got about 20 seconds to do that. So one of our students has just got that working. And so we get emails as soon as they think they've seen it. And that also means that you can send off alerts. Once you get really good at it, you can send off alerts to other telescopes, trigger them automatically as well, and just cut out, you know, hours or days of the time that humans would otherwise have spent.
So, as you've spoken about before, one of the big things with FRBs is localizing where they are on the sky. But also, how do you know how far away they are? Is it something within our... Well, I know that... Probably not something in our own galaxy, but how do we know that?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So that's actually what we're trying to do. We want to really prove that they're as far away as we think they are. So we think they're coming from well beyond the galaxy. So from basically billions of light years, and they've taken billions of years to get here. But we have to prove it. And the way to do that, we think, is to find, if you can just show that it comes from a particular galaxy, we know how to measure the distances to galaxies. There's, it's like 50 years of mature technologies that we can just take these things and attach them to the rest of astronomy and other things that we know. So that's the big aim.
Okay. Yeah, so I was going to say, once you've maybe, hopefully, pinned down some of the mysteries currently surrounding FRBs, if they are kind of on these greater distances outside our own galaxy, is there anything that we could use them for example, you know, to probe the space in between where they're coming from?
Yeah, that's another really, really good point. In fact, that's what really got my interest for this project. So for my PhD, what I worked on was figuring out how much our galaxy weighs. So it's well known that there's a lot of dark matter in the universe that's sitting around most galaxies. But what I concentrated on was not the dark part, but just figuring out how much the bit we can see weighs. And those are it's made up of what we call baryons, the material that makes up the table and people and planets and stars. When I heard about FRBs, I realized that these could be used to measure the number of baryons in the whole universe. So it seemed like a really nice thing to jump from doing it in the galaxy to doing the whole cosmos. So what what FRBs let you do is measure how many electrons there are between any galaxy that it came from and the Milky Way. And from there, you can figure out how much normal matter there is in the universe.
So another thing that comes to my mind of radio pulses that we receive on Earth is pulsars. How do FRBs compare to pulsars? Do you use similar techniques? Do pulsars crop up in your data a lot? And you think, oh, I might have found an FRB. Oh, no, it's just a pulsar again.
Yeah, that's good. Good point. So we actually spend most of our time looking for pulsars while we're searching for FRBs. So we just look for... We're timing pulsars and doing all kinds of pulsar science at the same time, and all the time keeping this constant software running, looking for the fast radio bursts. But the pulsars are great too, because they let us test our systems. You can go onto a bright pulsar. There's some really convenient ones in the southern hemisphere where they just let off these regular pulses, and you can check your system works. You can do that every day to keep everything tuned and so on. And then at the same time, we're measuring hundreds of pulsars every week, how they're spinning, and there's all kinds of science that you can do from that as well.
And from what I can gather, most of the FRBs that we've discovered have come from the southern hemisphere part of the sky. And I think that's kind of by virtue of which telescopes are looking for them. You've mentioned Parkes, Mongla. I think ASCAP's discovered quite a few now. And it's a little bit lacking in the northern hemisphere. Is there any reason for why the radio telescopes in the northern hemisphere haven't been picking up as many FRBs?
So they've just started to. So there's a big experiment in Canada called CHIME, and it's about to absolutely explode with FRBs. So it's an experiment was doing something completely different. It was looking at a time in the early universe after the Big Bang, when the universe went completely dark, and then stars eventually started to form. And what they did was all the gas in the universe got ionized, and there's lots of stuff, cosmology and things you can do with that. So CHIME was set up for that, but then FRBs came along and they realized they could retrofit and start to search for them, and it would just be an awesome discovery machine. And they're expecting to see many per day, or even hundreds per day when it's running, compared to us finding just a few every year. So it's going to really change everything.
Oh, wow. And so obviously the clue's in the name, fast radio burst. Are there any particular radio frequencies that are best for looking for FRBs? Are we looking at really low radio frequencies, looking at your kind of low frequency arrays, or do the dish telescopes also have a good run in?
Yeah, so they were discovered at around 1.4 gigahertz. So that's a common frequency that's used around telescopes around the world. It's a little bit higher than the mobile phone frequencies, for example, that we use. So if you go to lower frequencies, we didn't know what we'd see. At very low frequencies, it looks like that they're just not showing up. And there are some that have been seen at high frequencies, but it's a game that we'll be playing for the next couple of years, trying to map out how they run across the spectrum.
And you mentioned mobile phones in there. How much of a problem is RFI radio frequency interference from things like mobile phones?
Yeah, so that was the big issue when we started the whole project. So we started small because we had no idea. We had to be sure that mobile phones were going to wreck the experiment. So the mobile phones appeared, of course, long after the telescope was built, and they operate right in its operating frequencies. But mobile phones, they're, because the telecommunications companies also want to pick them up, they're actually very regular in how they communicate. And so, we can spot them pretty easily. So, and it turned out that the little valley that the telescope's in is nicely protected, and there aren't many people there. So only about 5% of the time is ruined by mobile phones, and we get 95%, and that's just fine.
Okay, that doesn't seem so bad then.
Yeah.
Okay, and you have touched on this a little bit, but where do you see the future of FRB study going? What is it that you'll be doing, and what is it you hope to see other people do as well?
Well, the next big thing is to get those host galaxies and figure out that So it'll be really exciting, like, to see what kind of galaxies do they come from. There'll be all kinds of clues there. So are they related to how stars, if they've got something to do with stars, how they relate to the history of stars in the universe, how many should we expect to see as we look further and further away? And all the experiments now, they've so beautifully poised to answer these questions. So I think within, like, yeah, in a year or two, we're just going to know so much more about these.
Brilliant. I'm sure that we'll be very interested to hear what's going on with FRBs in the next few years. We'll keep you posted, Jodcast listeners. So for now, thank you very much for joining me. Is there anything else actually you'd want to talk about before we head off? Any do you do anything other than FRBs?
Well,
or pulsars?
Yeah, I've just come back. I've just come from Copenhagen a couple of days ago here, and we're working on a project on Earthshine, which is the light that the Earth shines onto the dark side of the moon.
Oh wow, okay, that's quite different to FRBs then.
Yes, so what we've got is we've got a telescope, an automated telescope which takes images of the moon, and by looking at the amount of light on the dark side, we can measure how much bounce is bouncing off the Earth, and that's related to climate change.
Oh wow,
so
okay.
So the amount of light reflecting off the Earth is light that was, is energy that didn't heat the Earth, but the amount that went in is. So one of the questions we're asking is, with climate change, the amount of cloud cover can change, and the amount, the albedo of the Earth can change, and this would affect how you calculate global warming models, and we're using the moon to try to measure that.
Oh wow, okay. And have you, what kind of results have you been getting that so far, or is it still in its early stages?
Yeah, it's still in early stages, and we're still designing how we're going to run the experiment, and we're doing calibrations and checking things work and stuff like that.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. How did you get involved in that?
That was because I worked in Denmark for a while, and one of my astronomy colleagues left astronomy and went to work in meteorology and global climate science. And we were thinking about ways we could look at climate change from, using astronomical techniques.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, that's one of the things that I personally find really fascinating is the use of astronomical techniques in other disciplines. It does seem like astronomy can become a very interdisciplinary thing. So that's really interesting to hear about. Any other tricks up your sleeve? Anything else that you're up to?
The other project we've got running right now. So I've just been to China, and there's a satellite called Gaia. It's been waiting so long for it to come. So I was part of the original science case, helped write a few ideas for the original science case along with about 300 other scientists. And now we've all been waiting like more than 20 years for the satellite results. So the results came out, and they were absolutely spectacular. Could hardly believe that they were so good. And so what we're using them to do is try to measure the mass of the Milky Way. So this is like, takes us back. So now we've spent that time figuring out how much the part of the Milky Way we can see weighs. And with these data, we'll measure how much the whole thing weighs. And interest is those numbers don't agree at all. They differ by a factor of 10 or 20 or so. And that's the mysterious dark matter that is that our galaxy is sitting in, and that's we want to quantify those a bit better.
So how much of the galaxy can Gaia see?
Oh, for stars, we're looking at the whole thing. We basically see to the edge, and we can measure how tens of thousands of these things, how they're all moving around in the galaxy for the first time. It's absolutely not doable before Gaia, and you can see how they're moving in 3D space, and from that you can figure out like the balance between gravity that's holding them in place and how fast they're moving tells you the mass of the Milky Way.
Okay, so did you get any big surprises from that Gaia result, or was everything as you were expecting?
It was kind of as we were expecting, or at least as my colleague. So I had not been paying much attention to the field for a while, and she knew. And it actually kind of matched what people have been doing with models rather well. So that's always a nice thing. Sometimes you prefer to see, like, it's great to get a big surprise. That's the dream scenario in science. You want things not to fit. That's when you know. That's a sure sign of progress. But in this case, it was pretty good.
Brilliant. So are you going to be involved with, is there any more data analysis that needs to be done there, or any more theories to be formulated?
Yeah, there's lots of data. There's so many projects we can run with this, so we'll be busy for a decade. It's just absolutely fantastic data set.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Cool. And this is already three different things that you're working on at the moment. Do you have anything else up your sleeve?
That's about it.
That seems like that is quite enough for one person to be doing. But that's all incredibly interesting. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.